But first on BBC Radio 4, Simon Cox presents Club Class.
Who wouldn't want to be in the same club as James Bond? One so exclusive, you can't even mention you're in it. Where membership gets you fast cars, fast women, and a chance to save the world. While the reality of being in the spy club is more mundane, getting in is fiendishly difficult. For decades, the defence of the realm was left to patriotic chaps from good public schools and Oxbridge colleges who could be relied upon to keep a secret. But repeated intelligence failures and new terrorist threats mean the Secret Service has had to change. In this week's Club Class, I'll be examining the attempt by Britain's spymasters to break up the old cosy club and bring in a new breed of spies.
The atmosphere, certainly within MI5, was like a sort of gentleman's club stroke outpost of the Empire or of public school in Oxbridge.
The problem with MI6 is it tends to recruit these kind of almost psychopathically self-confident ex-public schoolboys who are very kind of charming and can do that kind of cocktail party circuit.
What they had was a lot of dead wood sitting in middle management who'd been there since about the late 70s, early 80s, who couldn't manage their way out of a paper bag.
MI6 is the ultimate club.
He may be forever synonymous with James Bond, but Sean Connery would never have had a hope of getting into the real MI6. Not because he wasn't smart enough, charming or tough enough, but because he wasn't part of the old boy network. In those days, the key to becoming a spy was who you knew rather than how good you were, according to Mark Hollingsworth, an author who's written a detailed account of life inside the domestic security service, MI5.
Well, historically, MI5 and MI6 recruited agents and officers basically on the old boy, old girl network. And it was mainly through family connections and social connections, friends. And they felt that to preserve secrecy, to preserve the sort of inner circle of confidentiality, they could only recruit people that they knew or were related or were friends or members of the same club or same school or same university. So that was the basis of the recruitment. So it was based on contacts rather than merit. And of course what happened there was that you recruit people who were not up to the job or were useless or unprofessional or could even be communists like Philby, McLean, Burgess and Blunt.
So the whole notion was the idea of secrecy was more important than competence.
Secrecy was more important than competence. But in fact that really didn't necessarily work because of all the spy scandals that we all know about.
And once you were in MI6, it was just like a gentleman's club for the upper classes, according to the intelligence historian Stephen Dorrell.
In the 30s, 40s and into the 50s, it was very exclusive, centred largely around a small group of senior officers, particularly C. Menzies, who was a well-known figure at White's Club. He used to stand at the bar with his pink gyms and he would recruit people at the bar. Most of the senior people in the 40s and 50s were his personal friends. But a lot of the people within MI6 in that period came from the same backgrounds. They went to the same clubs, besides White's, Reform, Travellers and others.
With no formal application procedure, spies were found through informal means. MI5 were unable to grant us an interview for the programme, but in a statement they did shed light on exactly how they used to recruit.
Traditionally, recruitment to MI5, like most aspects of the work, was kept secret. You were recruited because of who you knew. Usually existing staff made recommendations to the recruitment section. Or you got a tap on the shoulder at university because your tutor thought you were suitable.
The Foreign Intelligence Service, MI6, was no different, as the Today presenter Edward Sturton found out when he was approached after being recommended by one of his old Cambridge lecturers.
It was actually after I left university, it was about 3 months afterwards, and it was particularly surprising because I hadn't applied for any civil service jobs or diplomatic service or any of that kind. I only applied for journalism jobs, really. And suddenly a letter plopped through the letterbox. Dear Mr. Sturton, and it was a very curious phrase, said, it has been suggested to me, didn't say by whom, that you might be interested in a post in the field of foreign affairs not covered by the usual diplomatic entry procedures. And then there was a list of what you should do if you wanted to respond in a positive way, and there was an address somewhere in Whitehall, and at the bottom a signature that was completely illegible. You couldn't possibly have told who'd written the letter, and just recruitment officer written underneath. And accompany it was a form of quite mind-boggling detail, more or less, as I recall, asking what newspapers your great-great-grandparents read. I mean, you're any connection with any part of, from any part of your life which could have, I suppose, been a source of treachery was explored in this form. And I wrote back and said I was terribly sorry, I'd just been offered a traineeship at ITN, and anyway, I was far too indiscreet to be a spy. And I also remember at the time thinking it was a little odd, because I'd been in Guy Burgess's old rooms at Trinity, right. Fantastic rooms overlooking Great Court, and this wonderful Renaissance fountain you woke up to in the morning. But there was something sort of inappropriate, I felt, about asking somebody with these connections. And I suppose in a slightly more serious way, it seemed to me that, given the experience in the 30s at Cambridge, they shouldn't still, in the 1970s, which we were then in, be looking at sort of public school boys like me, frankly, sort of people who you assumed were just good chaps, which I think was the basis on which I was mentioned in whatever circles these things get mentioned.
A decade later, in the 1980s, the tap on the shoulder was still the favourite way to find new members for the spy club. The historian Andrew Roberts was talent-spotted by a don at his Cambridge college and began the long and arduous route to becoming an MI6 officer. He's given us a unique insight into the procedure. First off, an arduous series of meetings and interviews, followed by the bizarre MI6 exam questions.
There are a few completely straightforward ones that you'd expect a spy to need to know about, sort of length of rivers and things like that. They're sort of old, old geography questions from, you know, common entrance. But equally, there are also some completely absurd ones, which probably in the new politically correct modern MI6 they've got rid of now. But my favourite, the one that I remember at least, was place in order of social rank, Marquis, Duke, Earl, Viscount, Baron, Baronet, which really was a hangover from the old days, frankly.
Intellectually, he was up to scratch, but how about physically?
There was a very funny medical examination where the doctor asked me whether or not I was homosexual. And, I mean, had I been homosexual, it would have been pretty stupid to have said yes if I still wanted to be a spy. And so I said no. And he said, well, we often find that with Cambridge it's boys, and with Oxford it's drugs. Are you a drug addict? Of course, I also said no to that. And so he just seemed to sort of tick the boxes and allow me to go on to the next.
So far, so good. There was one final hurdle, the references, or vetting, to use the intelligence term. Andrew Roberts was worried his tangled love life would end his hopes of entering MI6.
The girl that I was going out with was, entirely unbeknownst to me, also sleeping with Andrew Neil and the cousin of Colonel Gaddafi, a girl called Pamela Bordes, who, when the News of the World also discovered that she worked as a House of Commons researcher, got very excited about this and put it all over the front pages. I then got a call from my MI6 minder and asked whether or not he could come over and talk to me about this. And apparently it had come up in a cabinet meeting. Margaret Thatcher had gone round the table asking all the cabinet ministers whether they'd ever slept with any prostitutes. And the various ministers answered, you know, in their own ways. And it's in many of their memoirs now. It was obviously quite an amusing occasion. But MI6 weren't at all amused. Until I explained, you know, the circumstances of the case. And I said, look, is this going to affect my chances of getting in? And they said, no, not at all. All it does is underline the fact that you are heterosexual. Which I thought was very, very broad-minded of them.
He did get into MI6, but turned down the life of a spy to write history books instead. MI5, meanwhile, had been trying to break up the club since the late 1970s. The catalyst was a review of recruitment ordered by the then Prime Minister James Callaghan. The result was an overhaul of recruitment to draw in people from a wider social background. Mark Hollingsworth, an author who's written about the workings of MI5, says the doors of the club only really began to open to different kinds of people in the 1990s.
They realised that they had to recruit people from a different, wider social background, not just Oxbridge, not just public school, from people all kinds of backgrounds. And so you had people coming in who were politically more open-minded, different approach, slightly more sceptical towards authority.
The most notable example of this new openness was when MI5 took the radical step of advertising. It couldn't go straight out and ask for potential spies. Instead, it created a suitably obscure and anonymous advert.
Godot isn't coming. Very little comes to he or she who waits. Much more comes to those who reach out and take new opportunities. If you've already achieved plenty, but now find yourself marking time, stuck in a rut, and unable to progress, then it's time to act. To use your strong interpersonal skills to move into a non-commercial organisation where an interest in current affairs is important.
Unfortunately for MI5, David Shaler's mother saw the article in the Independent's business section and told her son to apply. After all, it could do no harm.
It all happened by phone to start with. I went to a recruitment consultancy. And obviously this is a different way of doing it from the past. In the past they tapped people on the shoulder. And I did a few intelligence tests and a short interview, at which I was asked what I'd done to change the world. And having published extracts of Spycatcher in my student newspaper when I was editor, when it was under injunction, I point this out, thinking it was a journalistic kind of job. And they said, why did you do that? And I said, obviously, it's not the purpose of MI5 to destabilise democratic government. And they said, what about the national security implications? And I said, well, you know, anybody who was going to use those would have used it when a book was published in America. I doubt they would have got it out of my student newspaper. And that question came up at every stage of the recruitment process. They asked me the same question. I gave the same two answers because those are the right answers, basically.
David Shaler was part of a new generation of recruits who were different, not just because they didn't go to public school, but because of their willingness to question the old order. David Shaler's partner, Annie Machen, was another of the new breed of intelligence officer recruited into MI5. Their hopes of changing the service from the bottom up were soon thwarted by what they saw as a dogmatic culture, where orders were followed and difficult questions discouraged.
In 96, they recruited for the first time through newspaper adverts openly, I think because they were losing so many staff they had to. And of course they had masses of people trying to join MI5, about, I think it's 20,000 people applied, and they whittled it down and got rid of all the people who wanted their James Bond gadgets and all that sort of thing. And they found a number of very, very stunningly good people. They were amazingly bright, they had very good interpersonal skills, they could do a whole range of different work in MI5, and a lot of drive. And of course, once they were recruited, the organisation didn't know what to do with them. They would put them in filing jobs or something. And they just didn't train them up, people became demotivated again and left again. So it's a sort of cycle that they don't seem able to break.
And is that's because of a very particular culture that's within MI5?
I think so, yeah. I mean, people who stay there are perhaps the people who wouldn't know where else to work, where else to look for work. It becomes quite incestuous. It's a sort of a culture that becomes normal, for example. Once you've been there 5, 6, 7, perhaps up to 10, 15 years, that's just the office, as I said before, and it's an old culture that they wouldn't question what goes on there. It just becomes the norm. And those are the sort of people who'd be running the organisation.
David Shaler does have an axe to grind about MI5. After all, it pursued him for years and got him jailed for breaking the Official Secrets Act by selling his story to a newspaper. For defenders of the status quo, Shaler is perfect ammunition for keeping out grammar school upstarts who don't know the rules of the club.
I suppose your critics would say, wouldn't they, and those who want to keep the services as they are, would say, look, you're a great advert for not changing it because you've come in as an outsider and then you've broken the Official Secrets Act.
Yeah, but I'd say that I was pointing out the bleeding obvious to everybody there. I mean, absolutely bleeding obvious. And things that needed to be said about, say, MI6 funding Al-Qaeda, trying to assassinate Colonel Gaddafi and killing innocent people. Those are things that the services should not be involved with. Quite clearly they should be involved with. They're stopping terrorism. They're not getting involved in it. They're not putting bombs under people. That's a waste of all their time and effort. I think the problem with me was that the fact that I had a keener sense of human rights and how democratic rights work within written constitutions. And it was quite appalling to come into a situation in which you realised that those general rules of democracy were not being observed by MI5.
Machen and Shaler's experience as intelligence officers convinced them that secrecy is what's stopping reform of the club. Secrecy, supposedly used for the interest of national security, is in fact an excuse to prevent close scrutiny of what actually goes on within MI5 and MI6. But Professor Christopher Andrew, the intelligence service's favourite historian, says for the organisations to be effective, they have to be secret.
The simplest thing I think to say about any secret intelligence agency is from the moment that it stops behaving secretly, it ceased to be a secret intelligence agency. What does that mean? It means that, broadly speaking, the people who compose it should not be identified. Otherwise, when you send somebody to another country or to deal with a terrorist group in this country, they immediately identify the fact that you're coming. That is not a good idea. And that is why neither the names of the individuals involved nor their photographs or identifying particulars should become known.
MI6's name tells you all you need to know about its attitude to secrecy. Its official title is, after all, the Secret Intelligence Service. But the war in Iraq has brought it out of the shadows and into the spotlight. The Butler inquiry was scathing about the intelligence supplied by MI6 in the run-up to the Iraq War. In a newspaper article, Sir Peter Heap, a former career diplomat, suggests that the Iraq War reveals a culture within MI6 where secrecy came ahead of intelligence. When he was a deputy ambassador, he recounts seeing a top-secret report being sent by an MI6 officer to London. This supposed secret information had in fact been copied out of the local newspaper. Edward Sturton, too, was surprised when he was a diplomatic editor at the quality of the information he received from MI6.
When they were just beginning to come out of the shadows a bit, there was a sort of curious, almost a dead letter drop system, which allowed me to try and get a briefing with them about any subject that I wanted, and I would tell my editor, and my editor would ring up, you know, some mysterious person on a phone number that kept changing, and then a phone call would come back the other way. And it was just during the early days of the Balkans crisis, and I wanted a background briefing on Milosevic and what the Secret Service's assessment of his intentions was at that stage. This was just as Bosnia was beginning to get going. So we activated this extraordinary system for the first time, and duly two rather nicely dressed young people turned up in my office in ITN, and they're very charming and very intelligent, but they told me absolutely nothing that I couldn't have worked out from reading the newspapers.
Stephen Dorrell, who's written a history of MI6, says in order to break up the club, the Secret Intelligence Service needs a different approach to the whole notion of secrecy.
Malcolm Muggeridge, who was an MI6 officer, when he left, he railed against MI6 because of this absurd secrecy that did have a psychological effect on the way that people operated and thought about the world. You are in this secret ultra-club atmosphere. You are against the world because nobody else outside of it knows what's going on. You are the keeper of the secrets. You have all the secret material about the world.
Don't you have to have that secrecy in order to maintain it?
I think what happened over Iraq has shown, actually, secret agencies work, they're less and less successful. There's a big debate about creating open source agencies. It would be interesting to have a test on Iraq. Secret intelligence against open source intelligence. The material that came from journalists was far more reliable than the intelligence that came from MI6 or the CIA.
So would you need a different type of person? Would you need less and less of what we from the outside would think of as spies or field agents, and more people who analyse the material then, isn't that?
Every investigation into British intelligence, the Falklands, etc., the thing that comes up again and again is poor analysis. There aren't enough analysis. There aren't enough people with the required languages. There aren't enough kind of academic skills to assess the intelligence. You will require new type of people. It's said that actually journalists would make better intelligence officers. They have information gathering skills. They have ability to analyse material. And they have an ability to put it into a coherent form.
You say journalists are very good potential intelligence agents. What were the chances of me being taken on then if I applied?
I don't know. How old are you?
37.
No.
Too old.
You've missed your chance.
Undeterred by Stephen Dorrell's comments, I decided to test the new ethos among Britain's spymasters and see if I could join the club. Deep in the Foreign Office website is an address where prospective recruits should send CVs to MI6. I dutifully dispatched mine, along with a covering letter. Several weeks later, a 13-page application form arrives. It's short on intrigue and long on modern management speak. I have to outline my ability to build relationships, my proactivity, adaptability, planning and political curiosity, as well as providing 5 referees. After ploughing through it, I send it back.
I've got in front of me a phone number, which is actually a direct line to someone in MI6. I don't know his name, but he's going to talk to me about recruitment. Now, this is someone who we finally managed to get hold of after 4 weeks of emails and phone calls trying to get someone from the organisation to speak to us. And hopefully, he can answer some of the questions I've got about recruitment. So I'm just going to go ahead and call him. Unfortunately, we can't record his answers. We've got to speak to him off the record. So I'll tell you about what he said once I've spoken to him. Hello there. It's Simon Cox from BBC. I think you were expecting a call from me. Is that right?
How you doing?
Did you manage to get hold of the form that I'd sent in?
The man I spoke to had been with MI6 for 20 years. I wasn't told his name, and I could refer to him only as an experienced officer who could talk about recruitment.
OK. Well, look, thanks a lot for your help. All right. Thanks for that. OK. Bye-bye. Well, I don't know about my prospects to be a future spy. He said he was aware of my application, but he couldn't discuss it because it would break confidentiality of their personnel department, so he wouldn't want to discuss it. But he said he was aware of it, he was aware of my CV. He didn't tell me an awful lot, to be perfectly honest.
But I didn't just want to talk about my application. I wanted to know what MI6 was doing to get in new recruits. My MI6 source wanted to stress they were keen to get a diverse mix of recruits, but when it came to specific details, up came the barrier of secrecy. He couldn't, for example, tell me how many universities other than Oxbridge that they'd recruited from, or the ethnic mix of new recruits. He did admit they still use informal networks to find new spies, a strong hint that the tap on the shoulder still exists. We spoke to one recent Oxbridge graduate who had followed the old route, tapped after being recommended by a family friend. Having cleared the toughest hurdles, he came a cropper on the drugs test. But over at MI5, things are different.
Wake up, make toast, get train, brief manager, analyse intelligence, team lunch, disrupt terrorist organisation, make calls, go shopping, go to bed. For a life less ordinary, MI5, the security service.
MI5 is trying to be a model of openness. This is a radio version of their website advert for careers in MI5. They've even taken to putting ads in women's magazines. Their website, at least, reveals basic information about the percentage of women it employs and the number of staff aged under 40. Mark Hollingsworth, who's written critically about MI5 in the past, believes the domestic service is trying hard not to be a club.
I think security services certainly used to be a cosy club. Now they're more like a corporation in the sense that it's a much more professional outfit. It's more rigorous. Certainly in MI5, I think there's argument you can say that MI5 really cleaned up their act in terms of countering terrorism in this country. And they would never admit it. But it's partly due to Shaler's revelations that really shook them up, basically, and realised that combating terrorism is a totally different operation than combating KGB spies sitting around in London getting drunk on vodka.
But with MI6, it's much harder to gauge how much it's changed, as greater emphasis is placed on secrecy. But the author Nigel West, who's written extensively about the Secret Intelligence Service, that's MI6 to you and me, says intelligence failures in Iraq mean MI6 is at a critical point in its history.
This is a very bad moment in the history of intelligence. I'd go so far as to say that it is close to catastrophic. This is an organisation that has had 20 years to develop sources in a target country where the local population has been able to travel, so people who might be potential recruits could be pitched in third countries very easily. No problem with them travelling to the United Kingdom. Over a period of 20 years, knowing this to be a target, we can be certain that SIS recruited just 5 individuals, one of whom only reported gossip from his circle of friends in Baghdad, and two others turn out to be unreliable subsources of the other two. So that is the most damning indictment of the Secret Intelligence Service.
The new threats from Al-Qaeda and Islamic fundamentalism have undoubtedly brought a change in recruitment for MI6. They must have different recruits who can operate within the Muslim world. But the intelligence academic Stephen Dorrell says recruitment changes are not enough. There must be a change within the culture of MI6, where it no longer sees itself as superior to other intelligence agencies.
MI6 officers still regard them, I think, as being top of the rung, higher up than the other intelligence agencies. We can see that in terms of Iraq and the problems over Kelly, for instance, where they didn't really take on board the comments from the defence intelligence staff. They kind of dismissed them, and I think that's to do with that these are MOD people and we know what we're doing. And I think part of that goes to secrecy. MI6 is an ultra-secret agency. MI5 has released documents in the public domain, it has PR going on, people publish articles, the former Director General publishes books. MI6, no photograph of C. They've never released any documents into the public domain. There's nothing in the National Archives at Kew. So there's this ultra secrecy that's within it. And I think secrecy plays a big part, especially in that kind of insular, clubbable kind of state. And MI6 is the ultimate club.
The drive to modernise the old clubby image of MI6 does have drawbacks. The author Nigel West, a friend of the intelligence services, says MI6 must maintain the James Bond image, as it's one of their greatest assets.
The mythology that the Secret Intelligence Service depends on is, again, part of the culture. I remember talking to Colin McColl, who was the chief of SIS, who said, the truth is that James Bond is my best recruiting sergeant. He said that most people in the entire world have seen one James Bond film. So it doesn't matter whether you're up the Amazon, if you identify yourself as a member of the British Secret Intelligence Service, but likelihood is that the pygmy native that you are dealing with will have heard of James Bond and all that goes with it. So the advantages to SIS are very considerable.
There's no doubt MI5 is trying to shed its old image as a cosy club where loyal chaps from the right background could serve their country. MI6 too wants to be seen as a modern intelligence service. But unless they abandon some of their secrecy, they'll never convince the sceptics, and there are many after Iraq, that the club has closed for good.
The presenter was Simon Cox, and the producer was Richard Varden.